You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a very, very interesting statistic on the number of people who died as the result of Fukushima in the United States. Yes, I'm quite serious about this. We will be talking about this as we go on through the program today. Congressman Steve King, who represents the Republican from Iowa, will be with us in our second hour to talk about wackadoodle Republican politics going on in that state and what could happen. And I want to get into this in some depth. What could happen if Ron Paul becomes a serious player? I would submit that he already is, that he has had considerable influence on the Republican Party and the Republican field. And he's got this whole, I mean, it's now in or hip or what, fill in the word, right? For pick your generation and fill in the word to be a libertarian. And, you know, what I say, you know, I call libertarians Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, but they don't. So anyhow, he'll be here with our second hour. In our third hour, we're going to be talking about that and should we tax the churches and all kinds of interesting stuff. Right now, J.A. Meyerson is with us. He's an independent journalist and contributor to Alternet and Truthout and has a piece in The Nation titled OWS, Occupy Wall Street, Without a Space to Occupy Faces Organizational Challenges. J.A., welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great to have you with us. JAMeyerson.com, by the way, MYERSON.com is the website for your writing. And the Occupy Wall Street movement, this article characterizes it, you know, now in its kind of homeless position, you know, without Zuccotti Park, as frazzled or unraveling or something. You pick the adjective. What's going on?
I think unraveling is strong. I think frazzled is much nearer the mark. I mean, let's just, there is a sort of fracturing that has happened between two portions of the occupation, which is to say the people who were occupying the park, that's one group, who no longer are, right, because now they're homeless because the 12th richest man in the country deployed what he calls his army and made them homeless, and dispossessed them of all their stuff, their kitchen, their tents, everything.
Did you just say Bloomberg was the 12th richest man in America?
In America, $19.5 billion to his name, which is larger than the GDP of Estonia, which is a European country.
Yeah, I've been to Estonia. It's not an inconsequential country. The northern three of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia of the Baltic. Is it the Baltic Sea there? I forget. Anyhow, yeah. We went all the way up from Poland, all the way up through there on our way to Denmark. I've been there. Yeah. Anyhow.
Yeah, that's right. So he's got more money than that country has, and than the wealth that country's made this last year. And he's got an army. That's what he calls the NYPD, and he sent the NYPD in to take away people's homes, and they did that. So now there's folks who are homeless. And then the other part of the population that is sort of split off from that group because of this action on Bloomberg's behalf and Brookfield's behalf is the sort of activist organizational sector of Occupy Wall Street, which is in, you know, in 60 Wall Street when it can be, or its office at 50 Broadway. So there are people who are sort of doing the activist organizational part, and there are people who were holding down the park who aren't especially plugged into that sort of part of the occupation, who are now sort of split off from each other geographically, right? Some people are still hanging out in the park, and some people are up in these offices, and when that happens, right, tensions begin to arise. There's been a lot of movement since that article went up. The Housing Committee has gotten through a number of really good measures to find people housing in shelters and in churches and stuff. And, of course, on Saturday, the three-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street saw an attempt to reoccupy a different space, an attempt that was ultimately foiled by Trinity Church and the NYPD. But there's a lot of movement around, getting the movement to progress forward while caring for the people who are depending on the movement for sustenance. Some of these people were homeless beforehand. Some of them left their lives to come be part of the movement. Some of them are recent college graduates who, instead of moving back in with their folks or going to, you know, get steady employment and get a place, were living at the occupation, and now they have nowhere to stay.
Right. Now, there, you mentioned that there is about $1 million in their checking account, and there has to be a debate about how to use that. There are people who are concerned about that. Could they become victims of their own success? Do you expect them to just basically kind of go quiescent over the winter and then maybe come back, with a roar in the spring? Is there a possible change in tactics to, you know, flash mobs or occupy a particular street every day? What are the things that are being discussed? What are the options that they have?
I think the $1 million number is overstated. Justin Elliott at Salon recently did I can't remember what the figure he had was, but he did a really good breakdown of Occupy Wall Street's cash on hand and what's available. It's not as big as you'd expect. The donations sort of stop coming in eventually. What I expect is that the winter will be comprised of actions, like one a week. We had the Goldman action, and then we had the D-17 action. So there's these actions that are always happening, occupy our homes and stuff like that, continuing to mic check public officials and CEOs at every opportunity, continuing with foreclosure abuse resistance, professing solidarity with assorted movements around the world, especially Egypt right now, which is in a very difficult moment.
Yes.
So I think that that's essentially what the winter will consist of, right? Constant action. And then in the spring, I think you'll see, as you mentioned a second ago, an explosion of enthusiasm that will see huge numbers of occupations spiking up all over the place. I just saw a piece yesterday that Occupy San Francisco, that there are all these tiny little micro occupations on all these streets all over the place, one tent, two tents, that have just sort of spread across the entire city. I think that's a wonderful idea, and I bet it could be replicated really beautifully in New York in the spring.
Yeah, very interesting. Although there is safety in numbers, and we'll see. I mean, it's one of those things you just don't know, if we were to look back at the Hoovervilles of the 1930s, there were occupation movements all across the United States. The largest and most famous was in Seattle, where the mayor of that Hooverville, kind of an honorary title, actually, a fellow by the name of Jesse Jackson, as a matter of fact, wrote a book about it in 1935. And those occupation movements, in part, led to much of the New Deal. I mean, they just kind of they certainly to the housing reforms that FDR did. And we'll see how this shakes out. In the minute we have left, Jay, how can the average listener, viewer, person, whatever, support what they're doing?
Oh, I have the perfect answer for you, but it doesn't come from me. It comes from Walter Mosley at The Nation.
Mm.
He has this column that he does there, 10 Things You Can Do, and the most recent one was 10 Things You Can Do to Help Occupy Wall Street. I would go and Google Walter Mosley, and his Ray Gomez is the other person who publishes it with him, R-A-E-G-O-M-E-S.
Okay.
10 Things You Can Do to Help Occupy Wall Street.
Is that Walter Mosley, the novelist?
Walter Mosley, the novelist, and who's on the editorial board of The Nation.
I didn't realize he was on the editorial board of The Nation. He was one of our Conversations with Great Minds conversation some time back.
Okay.
He's over at conversationswithgreatminds.com. We did a half-hour-long-form interview with him. Smart guy, in addition to being a brilliant writer. Okay, J.A. Meyerson, jamyerson.com, the website, independent journalist, contributor to Alternet, Truthout, and The Nation. Thank you, J.A.
Have a good one.
You too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what if you were running the Occupy movement? Obviously, nobody is, but what would you do next? Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. 10 ways to support the Occupy movement, 10 reasons why OWS matters. Thank you, Jacob, for digging these out. Once again, what was the source? Oh, this is Yes Magazine. Okay, great. 10 ways to support the Occupy movement. Show up in person and participate at the local occupied space near you. Start your own occupation. Support those who are occupying. Get into the debates and teachings. Share your 99% story. Be the media. Start a meaningful conversation. Insist the public officials and powers treat the occupation with respect and vice versa. Study and teach nonviolent techniques. That's number 9. I'd make that number 1. Actually, be resilient. Number 10. I'd make that number 1. And study and teach nonviolent techniques. Number 2. 10 reasons it matters. Name the sources of the crisis. I don't know if you noticed, but nobody was talking about wealth inequality in America before the Occupy Wall Street movement. Start the conversation for a new world that works for the 100%, not just the 1%. This is like really a novel idea in American, you know, since the Reagan administration, there's been virtually no discussion of this. It was a big deal during the administrations of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Even Gerry Ford a little bit talked about, you know, after Nixon, and even Nixon actually talked about, you know, what's best for all the American people. But that conversation pretty much came to a grinding halt with Ronald Reagan and the idea of trickle-down economics, and that if all the efforts of government and business were directed to that top 1%, everything would be wonderful. So what do you think should be done? Keith, in Taos, New Mexico?
Taos. Yeah, I'm over here in Taos, New Mexico.
Okay, what's up?
Yeah, America's oldest town. Well, anyway, I'm Keith with the Food Not Bombs, and I've been helping support the occupation since, back in May even.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped put up some kitchens and like Occupy DC and helped at Wall Street. And I actually wrote about how to organize an occupation because I participated in one in 89 that was amazing. And I really think we should get back out on the streets and try to reclaim the public space, because that was really what had our energy and our power. And I think all the other great ideas that are happening, foreclosure, takeovers and stuff are fantastic.
Well, here's the problem. In the Northeast, those public spaces are getting really cold and really inhospitable. B, they were filling up with homeless people and junkies, which is not to put down homeless people and junkies, but they were disproportionately represented in these populations. And so it was really hard for activists to be activists and be social workers, basically. And C, the police were reclaiming those public spaces. And, you know, there's... Go ahead.
I think we should still retake them.
I think it's going to happen in the spring. I think that's going to happen.
I'm homeless myself, but I think that we should, you know, and I've been living outside at the occupation. I have the flu now because of living outside for the last, like, 3 months at occupations. But I do think that it's important that we... one, Food Not Bombs, of course, feeds the hungry and homeless for now for 31 years. So a lot of those people coming actually were our friends, as we have kitchens at many of the occupations around the world. I've even been getting emails from Europe and Australia from Food Not Bombs chapters helping with the kitchens on Occupy Budapest, stuff like that.
Right.
And it is cold. I mean, it was, it was 9 degrees last night for me sleeping in my van, so I know what cold's about.
Wow.
But I think, people go to foodnotbombs.net, and I have actually a proposal to, in this, from this point of view. And I know it's hard with the cops.
Yeah.
I know it's hard with it being cold, but I just think that the power that, the authorities want us not to be occupying public space because they know it's really effective.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is the power of, and I mean this in a totally positive way, not a derogatory way, it's the power of street theater, basically. It's the power of public appearance, public spectacle. It's the power of what's visible. Americans don't notice something if they can't see it. And so, you know, if the Occupy people are having all kinds of meetings, but they're having them, you know, in church rectories or in office building, you know, in the basement of the office of the local church, nobody notices it. If they're doing it out in public, out on the street, it's impossible to miss, and the cameras will pick it up. And you know, if it happens on TV, then it happens in America. If it doesn't, it seems not to. So, Keith, I think you make a very, very good point, an excellent point, actually. Rigo in Orange City, Orange County rather, excuse me, you have a suggestion.
Yes, I do. Am I on air?
You are, sir.
Yes, sorry. I would occupy the 12 players that brought this economy down to the knees, one of them being Paulson and the second one being our congressman from Orange County, California, Christopher Cox. That man has literally disappeared. So we should bring back to light the original 12 players that were outed in CNN News back in, I believe, 07, 08.
Well, I think you'd have to look at Alan Greenspan and you'd have to look at Phil Graham. These were the major. I'd say that those were the two principal players behind it. And then some of the ideological, you know, the Stephen Moore and Art Laffler and Jude Winiski's dead now, but there's a few others. I mean, going back to Reaganomics that really set all this thing up, but Greenspan in particular, Ayn Rand, if you want, I mean, you know, the whole objectivist and libertarian movement.
Oh, most definitely. Bring it to light. I mean, bring it back to its original source.
Chris Cox, is he your member of Congress? You said he has all but vanished. He's still a member of Congress. You mean he's just not holding town hall meetings? He's not showing up for any public events?
You know what? He's like disappeared in the wind. He's like nowhere to be heard, nothing. He was hired by President Bush when Bush ousted a person overseeing the regulations on the mortgages. So Chris Cox turned his cheek and just, you know, didn't see it or you know,
was
just
that,
didn't want to bother.
Was that 2005 when the Attorney General Spitzer in New York was trying to prosecute the banksters for these mortgages and the Bush administration came in with this old maritime law from the 1860s and said, no, you can't do that?
It was around that area, yeah, and Christopher Cox was a big player on that.
Yeah, interesting. There you go. Thank you very much for the call. Interesting suggestion. We'll get back to more right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What do we occupy? How do we do it? How do we make the statement? How do we wake America up and provide a positive example for the world? Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. The place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. What would you do if you were Lord High Commander of the Occupy Movement? What suggestions would you make? Somebody sent me a note saying, well, go to Wall Street and occupy an elevator. Just go up and down and up and down and up and down all day long. I don't know. That probably wouldn't last very long. Tomas in Grand Rapids listening on WTKG. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
Hey, he's your right-wing brother, baby.
How you doing?
Hey, you know, I've joined Occupy Marines. It's a site on Facebook, all the devil dogs out there. And I want to talk to you about Wuhan. It's a city in China that has been surrounded by the security forces now for, I think, 3 weeks.
Yeah, they've revolted against the central government.
Right, and then it's spreading now to another bigger city all across South China. I think Occupy ought to be able to try and occupy maybe a Chinese consulate, and because, you know what, if the Chinese get behind this movement, it's going to be big.
Well, you know, we've gone from... When the United States came into existence, there were about a billion people on the planet. In fact, there were a little fewer than a billion people on the planet. Our second billion people came into being in 1800. 1800 was the first billion. The second billion was 1930. The third billion was 1960, John Kennedy. The fourth billion was 1974. 14 years. The fifth billion was 1987, 13 years. The sixth billion was 97, roughly thereabouts, 11 years. And now we're on the seventh billion. So if you look at that population explosion curve, what you see is that worldwide, you've got this massive amount, this massive number of people who are on the planet now, and many of them are very, very young. I mean, many of the countries of the world, some of the older industrialized countries are aging, Japan notable among them. But most of these countries where you're seeing the occupation movements going on, you've got huge quantities of young people coming out in the streets. It's a generational thing as well as a reaction to business cycles and all that other kind of thing. And I don't think it's going to be limited to any one country. I think that this is a meme that has gone viral worldwide. And Tomas, I think you've nailed it down and identified it. And it's happening in country after country after country. And there's a reason why, and that's because in country after country after country, the Chicago School of Economics, the Milton Friedman, the von Hayek, the Thomas Friedman, the world is flat, all this stuff, the get yours while you can, the me stuff, has taken hold, and people are realizing how toxic it is. Bob in San Jose, listening on Green 960. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I think with Michael Moore's famous question from Sicko, are we a me society or are we a we society, is right there, and it's a mindset.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking of this as a we society, it isn't hard to look around and find something.
Something to occupy, something to do, something to work for. Yeah.
I mean, and in fact, this past weekend you contributed to one called the Occuthon.
Yeah. My contribution was rather small, but Jacob just worked his absolute butt off here.
Right, I know he did. Yeah. He did. I was part of that, online for a while. You say that.
Yeah.
It's creativity. It's looking for opportunities to let people know that we are a we society.
Yeah, absolutely.
And inclusive. Invite people in.
Yeah, there you go. And that's the meme that I think we need to run with as much as possible and as often as possible, because it's the first three words of the Constitution: we the people. It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life without health care, for example? How can you have liberty without a basic standard of living? How can you have the pursuit of happiness without basic needs being met? And what role does government play in doing that? What role does business play in doing that, for example? How do we establish the rules for that? These are the debates and the discussions we need to be having in America. Bob, well said. Thank you so much. Stephen in L.A. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for listening to KTLK. What's up?
Well, I blog frequently with people on the right side of the aisle just to get a better understanding of their thought processes. And one thing I keep coming up against is people advocating the Austrian School of Economics. And
right.
Most of these people are associated with the von Mises Institute.
Yep.
And it seems to me when you connect the dots to what caused the Wall Street meltdown is deregulation. And, the whole economic meltdown here in the country is a deregulation of private sector and privatization and lower taxes.
Right, which is what von Mises is all about.
Right. And so I was just wondering, to the extent that they influence policy, because I think Milton Friedman and some of the other policy people who had influence on making government policy over the last 20 years are advocates of this. And I wouldn't say it's a conspiracy or something like that, but it certainly is of concern to me that there's a very organized and calculated effort to implement these policies that have caused so much damage in our economy. Yeah. And it seems that they even want to do it more. They're not satisfied. I think
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm fine. I'm done. That's basically the point.
Okay. These policies are tremendously helpful to billionaires and oligarchs. They're tremendously useful to people who want to have the unlimited ability to acquire wealth and power and to aggregate companies in ways that eliminate competition from the marketplace. From Hayek to von Mises to Milton Friedman to Tom Friedman, in his, kind of pseudo liberal, but no, the earth is flat. Everybody can do anything, quack. And of course, Ron Paul, right at the center of all this, the whole libertarian notion. You look at and the Koch brothers and Dick Armey, and it really what it is it's an advocacy of oligarchy. It's an advocacy of old style kingdom without using the word kings. It's and the fact that Ron Paul wants to do away with the inheritance tax, what he refers to as the death tax, tells me that they actually want to go back to a hereditary monarchy or a hereditary aristocracy, a hereditary plutocracy, because, you know, you then will have these multi-generational, massive wealth families, and when they're the ones that can control the political dialogue, you know, given the Supreme Court decisions, they end up being the ones who control the country. So, yeah, Stephen, I think you're absolutely right. You've identified the ideology. Adam Curtis, who is a documentarian who's done a number of brilliant specials for the BBC, has done a couple of pieces that are really worth Googling and watching. Each one is about 3 hours long. One's called The Trap, and that's the one that most talks about this kind of thing. And they just, you know, they won't play them in the U.S. You know, PBS would not play them, which is really, really a shame. But anyhow, Jack in West Lynn. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, so Occupy Political Machine.
That's a great idea.
Start an let me get my phone off of that. Occupy Town Hall, Occupy Government, Occupy Congress, and run an Occupy candidate for president.
Yeah. How about occupy the position of precinct committee person?
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. Political block, political captains, and just start a regular political machine.
Become.
Why do you think it hasn't started? Done
occupy
yet?
The machine, basically. We could occupy the machine, the machine becomes ours. That's what the Tea Partiers did. They occupied the Republican machine, and boom.
Yeah.
Now they're calling the shots. I mean, you know, they've got John Boehner terrified.
Do you think that would be a good idea to start an Occupy political party?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've been calling for that from day one, so I'm totally with
you. Why do you think they haven't done it?
I think they haven't done it because a lot of the Occupy folks this is their first experience with or exposure to the system, as it were, and they don't have a clear, you know, they haven't seen I don't want to call them unsophisticated because I think some of them are far more sophisticated than most voters. But
I've noticed that you've had a very kind of wait and let's see kind of attitude about this.
Yes,
where do you think this is going?
I don't know. And that's why, you know, that's why I'm not out there trying to lead it and I'm not trying to push it. The one thing that I know about movements, having been part of, you know, one big one and parts of smaller ones over the courses of the 5+ decades I've been on this planet, is that movements are, they're organic. It's like watching a flock of birds or a school of fish. You can't predict which way they're going to move. They do actually for a reason. There is a collective intelligence to a movement. And somebody like me on the outside, or even one person on the inside, can't always, and in fact can't usually, say this is what the collective intelligence of the movement says to do.
But Tom, don't you think that it's inevitable that it has to go the route of a political machine or die?
Typically, that's what's happened. Whether it was the abolition movement, whether it was the early progressive movement, whether it was the Grange movement, which was the farmers organizing against the Wall Street banksters, whether it was the break up the big oil companies movement, the populist progressive movement, whether it was the women's rights movement, whether it was the civil rights movement, they all ended up occupying political positions. But none of them started there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in fact, they're not starting there is what gave them so much juice that they could then influence the political system.
Fight Jack!
Absolutely. This is what democracy looks like. By the way, I'm looking at whitehouse.gov/economy/jobs/we-can't-wait, which you can probably fairly easily find off whitehouse.gov. Here's this clock, 11 days, 11 hours, 9 minutes, 32 seconds until middle-class taxes go up. The Democrats are calling the bluff of the Republicans. Harry Reid, the president, they're saying to John Boehner, okay, you said we had a deal. And then Eric Cantor and his Tea Party crazies, put the shiv in your back. That's not our problem. Good luck. This is getting very entertaining. Gary in Ann Arbor, listening on AM 1310. Hey, Gary, what's up?
How you doing, Tom Hartman? Nice to speak with you.
Thank you.
Got my Tom Hartman for President T-shirt on today.
Where'd you get that?
I made it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, but, you know, very, very informative. I mean, you talked about the water cooler wars. I definitely come out on top every time. But
that's great. So what's up?
Yeah. Yeah, you're talking about those, in reference to those Occupy Wall Street situation. I wondered if with the election situation, with all these election suppression states going on, you know, with all these new laws and, you know, suppressing the vote deal, will Obama and his what's his name, the Attorney General, will they get on top of that? You know, well, I guess I'm trying to relate it to the Occupy Wall Street, saying that, I mean, I know this movement is only going to get stronger with time, especially next year when with all of this stuff going on with these new laws and especially the vote law. But my question is, are they conscious, or do you think it's going to be some type of movement where people will actually wake up and foresee this Bush thing that went down in Florida with how Bush and, you know, and Gore, that problem they had with the Chads,
yeah.
You know, this is going to be where they have police officers policing the voter booths or the voter places, you know, stopping people from voting because of these new laws, and find out later that, you know, the injustice, they stole another election type deal.
They're already doing it. I mean, they're already setting, the Republicans are setting this thing up. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, funded by the Koch brothers, has, you know, come up with model legislation for states that's being introduced by ALEC members, mostly Republican members of state legislatures. And you've got this kind of legislation now in some, you know, several dozen states that is going to prevent at least 5 million people from voting who think that they're going to be able to vote. They're going to show up at the polls and discover that, the student ID doesn't work, or, oh, that driver's license, you're 75 years old, that driver's license you haven't used in the last 10 years, even though it's yours, or that passport that you haven't renewed in the last 15 years because you haven't traveled, even though it was actually issued to you, that doesn't work anymore either. You've got to, you know, and because it's expired, and, you know, so you can't, you're not going to be allowed to vote. This is insane. You know, Eric Holder came out a couple days ago and said basically anybody who is an American citizen, and, you know, we have those records, right? It's the Social Security Administration keeps track of that. You're assigned a number when you're born.
Right.
Anybody who is an American citizen and who is 18 years old should automatically be eligible to vote. And basically I think that we should have federal legislation that provides a mechanism for this, that sets this up within the Social Security Administration, and just hands that database off to the states. And you can't, the federal government, because of the 10th Amendment, can't force the states to do this, but the states, the 9th and 10th Amendments, but principally the 10th, but the states should do this. They should simply say, okay, you know, if you're in the federal database, when you show up, you can vote. And all you have to do is in some way show that, you know, you are you. And, but see, that's where it gets complicated. But the fact of the matter is that people are more likely to be struck by lightning than to commit voter fraud. I mean, you had, you know, the Bush administration spent tens of millions of dollars trying to find voter fraud, and they found, what, 7 cases or something? And those were all people who were felons who thought they, who didn't realize that they lived in a state where felons weren't allowed to vote. And they had always voted before their felony, and after their felony, they went into voting, and boom, they got busted. And, I mean, this is just insane, this whole idea of voter fraud. This is nothing more than a shill argument to keep young people, poor people, minority people, and old people who are typically Democratic voters, Democratic Party voters, from voting. It's that simple. It's voter disenfranchisement. And yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I believe you're right that people are going to wake up. People are getting very, very angry. And you know, well, we'll see where it goes. Gary, thanks for the call. Rob in Mesa, Arizona, he says you want to disagree with me. What's up?
Well, I guess, Tom, thanks for taking the call. I disagree in that I think that the Occupy movement should not organize. They should not do anything, because I think once you organize, then you're going to have rules and, ways of breaking the thing apart.
Yeah.
They should almost be like a non-union union or if they're going to organize, they should organize almost like a faith group, saying, you know, faith in America. That way they'll be tax exempt at least.
If you understood me to say that the Occupy movement should turn itself into a political party, or it should as a movement take over the Democratic Party, please allow me to retract that. What I'm talking about is individual people. I think that it's just like I say, you know, hey, you can be in the Green Party and the Democratic Party. You can be an activist with Democracy for America or Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, and be in the Democratic Party So that's what I'm saying.
I think the Occupy movement has a lot of clout when you think of it as a cloud of votes.
Yeah.
The wealthy have a cloud of money. And a cloud of votes will always, be able to get more done because, you know, we're the voters, basically.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Rob. Thank you very much for saying it. Jake in Santa Barbara, we got about 30 seconds, Jake, until this hour's up.
Only 30 seconds. I just wanted to say that I'm more McKeynesian after watching all the economic hoo-ha, the contrivances that are going on, because the Austrian school, it almost looks like these economic crises have been created in order to make the Austrian school, the von Mises school, seem like the only answer.
Right.
And it's the kind of thing where you look at all these things that are going on and you say, wait.
Not only are you right, but Naomi Klein wrote a book about it. And, you know, the shock doctrine about disaster capitalism. And you're absolutely right. And there is an effort, a plan, as it were, to say, oh, well, this, you know, here's the crisis, here's the solution. And these guys did it in Chile, they did it in Argentina, they did it all over the world. And they're trying to do it here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. Wow, lots of stuff going on. 1 in 45 children in the United States, 1.6 million kids, 1 in 45, that's about one for every average classroom size in the United States, is homeless. Meanwhile, it's raining cash on Wall Street. The top banks are going to take home $165 billion this year just to split up as bonus pay among their top executives. The only reason they still exist is because we bailed them out in the hopes that they would bail us out, which didn't quite happen. Meanwhile, 40% of all the wealth in the United States belongs to the top 1%. In ancient Rome, it was 18%. Are we going the way of ancient Rome? Congressman Steve King, the Republican from the great state of Iowa, representing the 5th District of that state, on the line with us. Congressman King, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me back, Tom. I appreciate it.
You know, in light of the statistics that I just shared, I was just looking at your homepage over at steveking.house.gov, and your homepage is Bible Bans Keeping Christ in Christmas. Don't you think that Jesus Christ would be horrified by this level of inequality in the United States?
I was multitasking when you delivered the statistics, Tom.
Okay.
So I'm not sure.
1 in 45 kids in America is homeless right now. 40% of all the wealth in this country belongs to the richest 1%. In Rome, it was 18% when the empire began to crumble. And the banksters on Wall Street are setting to pass out to themselves as bonuses $165 billion, just to a few thousand banksters. Enough money, you know, to go back to Eisenhower's Cross of Iron speech, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where he said, you know, one destroyer could build, you know, 70 schools and 400 homes and things like that. Just think what could be done with that. I mean, that's a mind-boggling amount of money. And these guys have that money because we and the Fed bailed them out.
You know, we're going to be pretty close to on the same side of that one with the bankers, Tom. When we see that these entities that were, it should have really been spent too big to be allowed to fail, if that's what you believe, rather than just too big to fail. I think we would have been better off to let those banks fail. That would have put responsibility back in the financial industry. It would have taken this $1.65 billion in bonuses. I think that maths out to what you said.
No, it's $165 billion.
That's the number?
$156 billion in bonuses.
oh, I want to dig into that and take a good, good look at those dollars.
Yeah.
Not that I wouldn't be concerned about $1.65 billion, Tom. I am, but that is a colossal figure.
Yeah, I better double check that and make sure that that's right, because I'm reading it from my newscast here, but
yeah,
that is a huge figure, isn't it?
Well, didn't they give that to you in the 1,000 million category?
Yeah. Congressman King, let me double check on that before I go any farther, because I don't. You're right. That's more money than we spent in Iraq for 2 years.
Oh,
so,
way more. But going back to this principle that I think you and I do agree on, and that is that when the federal government decided that these large investment banks and then AIG throw that into the mix were too big to be allowed to fail because their results would be catastrophic to this economy.
Right.
I took the position that that they understood that when they were taking those risks. Back in the fall of, if I can pick my year, I think it was fall of 2006, maybe 07, but it was when we were first starting to talk about the subprime mortgage crisis. I had an investment banker as a guest speaker for a breakfast that I host on Wednesday mornings, and he'd been 30 years in the investment bank business. We didn't know this calamity was coming. It was just a dialogue on the toxic mortgages that they would become. And he said, what you do when you're in this investment banking business is pretty much what everybody else does. That way, if they're making money, you're making money, and if things fall apart and there is a bailout, you'll be bailed out with the rest of them.
Right.
That psychology told me the whole story. I mean, that was the backdrop for the story. Nothing's ever the whole story. That unfolded then in the subprime mortgage crisis, the toxic debt, Henry Paulson's Chicken Little Day, TARP 1, TARP 2, and all the things that have flowed from that now put our grandchildren yet to be born in debt.
This is the area where I think that the populist Tea Party and the populist Occupy Wall Street find themselves on the same side of the page. But you represent Iowa. Iowa's about to have the straw poll. We've got Ron Paul seems to be the flavor du jour. 2 days ago, it was Newt Gingrich. 3 weeks ago, it was Herman Cain. Now there's talk that Sarah Palin is going to jump back in. Holy, I just don't think she's going to give up her multimillion dollar paycheck with Fox News in order to do that. But you know, who knows? What are your thoughts on what's going on with the Iowa caucuses? Who do you think is going to win?
This
is your state
at this point,
and your party.
This is the most confusing, least predictable that I have ever seen. And, you know, as looking at this, I'm starting now in the last 3 or 4 days to hear people talk about a bifurcated race. That means it actually isn't bifurcated, but it would be if you view Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney as the establishment candidates, and that starts to debate rather than a definition.
Right.
And then you look at the candidates Rick Santorum and Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann as the constitutional conservative candidates. The bifurcated race is who emerges from those three constitutional conservatives to lead and who wins between Romney and Gingrich. Meanwhile, Ron Paul's an entity unto himself. That's how they're analyzing it now.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a reasonable analysis. And Ron Paul has this cult-like following, and it's growing like crazy, of young people on the TV show that we do, I work with a whole lot of people in their 20s, and it just blows my mind how many people have no idea what his real economic policies are and what he's all about. You know, I mean, for example, there would be no federally guaranteed student loans if Ron Paul was in charge. And there would be no free public education like, you know, California used to have, like most states used to have. I mean, Abraham Lincoln put into place, as you well know, the land-grant colleges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of that would exist if Ron Paul was president, period.
And additionally, and I asked him this question directly in Columbia, South Carolina on the Labor Day forum that we did with Jim DeMint and Robbie George, what would you do with our military, our standing military, our armies, our ground forces? And he said, bring them all home, back to the United States, inside the sovereign boundaries of the 50 states.
Right.
Then
well,
what about our Air Force and our Navy? Bring them home too.
So, yeah, I mean he's very Thomas Jefferson in that regard. Jefferson inherited a 300,000 man army in the election of 1800 and had it down to in the neighborhood of 6,000 people by the end of 1808. Which you know some historians blame him for that, saying that's why we had such a problem with the War of 1812 was because he basically wiped out the military. But he wanted it to be replaced by militia. But that's a whole other thing. But you know, he, I think that there's a lot of young people who find a lot of appeal to that, Congressman King. You know, they say, you know, why are we playing empire all over the world other than to protect the oil? And why don't we just stop importing all that oil? You know, if we had followed the policy that Jimmy Carter started, you know, and said we'll never again import more oil than we did in 1978, then, you know, today we would not be importing oil.
His plan didn't work out so well, but I will say in Jimmy Carter,
Reagan put an end to it.
He initiated the oil shale efforts in Colorado during that period of time, and that had long been labeled a boondoggle, and of course it's not necessarily opened up so much in Colorado today. But the oil shale and the oil is tremendous. So that part's been working.
Yeah, but and Texas now has online 10 megawatts of solar power. That's 10 nukes of solar power. Most Americans have no idea that just one state has, it's wind power. 10 nukes worth of wind power in just one state.
Well,
the solar power is the fastest growing form of energy in the United States. And it's one of the fastest growing industries.
And on the wind, I can count at least 39 wind chargers from my lawnmower where I live. and I do still mow my lawn, Tom. And additionally, 20% of the electricity that's consumed in Iowa is wind-generated electricity.
Yeah.
We do have good solutions we can work on together.
We do. We do. And I think that we need to be working on them, and we need to be putting this country back together rather than screaming at each other. Congressman Steve King, steveking.house.gov. Thanks for dropping by today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
We will see how this all shakes out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think that's the first time we have not ended up calling each other names in a long, long time. 15 minutes past the hour. I must be just in a good mood today. I don't know. Maybe it's the season.
Teach your children well. Teach their father's hell. Did slowly go by and feed them on your dreams. The one they fix,
let me
the one you know by.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And by the way, in our first hour, most of the conversation that we had was we talked with J.A. Meyerson, who's got a piece over at The Nation about how the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York City is really struggling right now without a physical place and struggling to have a presence, to decide what to do about the presence. It's a challenge for them. You know, Mayor Bloomberg, I think he said he was the 14th richest guy in America, 12th richest guy in America. Thank you, Jacob. And it's incredible, has just kind of stomped him like a bug. And they're resilient. They're coming back. I think that the spring you're going to see a huge resurgence. They're doing weekly things. But one of the questions we asked is, what should they be occupying? And people calling in saying they should be occupying the political parties. They should be occupying public spaces. They should be occupying political offices. They should be occupying, one guy said occupy elevators on Wall Street. It's like, who knows? Who knows? But there's lots of possibilities out there. Lots of them. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I hail from the state of the Senator Ron Johnson, who's a libertarian in the vein of Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
And as you know, he thinks we have the best healthcare system in the world.
And we do if you're a billionaire.
Right. And the thing is, those who follow the philosophy of Ayn Rand think that everybody should be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
Well, I'm on Social Security Disability and Medicare, and if it weren't for that social safety net, I might not be alive today.
Wow.
This last month, I had to go into the emergency room with severe abdominal pains, and they, when I was in the emergency room, holding room, a financial counselor from the hospital came in and asked me about my insurance. And it wasn't until after she came in that they did the tests on me and found out that I had severe appendicitis.
Yikes.
And,
But it wasn't until they found out that you were insured.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And I'd just like to ask Ron Johnson, would it be better if I had just died and not received that surgery that saved my life?
Well, I can tell you that some of the people in the Republican debates, you know, the people when Ron Paul was asked that question were yelling, literally yelling, let him die. So I think the answer is yeah. But, you know, that's that libertarian streak in America, Noah. Thank you for the call. That is so incredibly potentially destructive, frankly. And, you know, that we have to push back against. Karen in Portland. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring up Gene Sharp's work. He was featured in a documentary on Current TV that's still running off and on. And he's a strategist. And I think the Occupy movement needs to look at his work. For example, he says there are pillars of power that uphold a dictatorship, and we need to identify them and then try to co-opt them or weaken them. For example, the police and the army, they're pillars, right?
Yeah.
And rather than making them our enemy, we should seek to get them to identify with us so they won't beat us up.
Right.
And that's been happening to some
extent.
So
how do you do that?
Well, for example, his work's been used in the Orange Revolution and other places, anti-Milosevic Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
People sticking flowers in the gun barrels.
Sure.
Or women offering flowers.
Right.
To
talking
soldiers.
To them nicely. I mean, one of the things that you saw after the Civil Rights Movement was those areas in the South where you had white police forces that were very hostile to minority communities were integrated. And suddenly those white cops were working side by side with African-American cops, and with an integrated police force, not only did the nature of the policing change, but the nature of the police changed.
Yes, it's happened in, identification has happened in Portland. At least one policeman was crying when the camps were broken down.
Yeah.
And many times they've been kind to protesters.
Yeah.
And another pillar would be the workers. So that we must seek to have participating in planning and being with us rather than doing things that would rub them the wrong way. I'm not going to get specific, but that's another way to look at our relationship.
Yeah, and this is by the way, if I may, Karen, this is the mm-hmm. nonviolence training that's been going on in a lot of the Occupy camps around the country.
Yes,
Karen, I just have 1 minute to the break. I want to get another caller in. Thank you very much. Your points were so spot on. Josh in Pasadena, that minute's yours. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just had something to say about the Austrian school of economics. And, you know, I think that Ron Paul is actually really well-intentioned, and I think he has, like, a moral, ethical crisis as evidenced by that question about healthcare. You know, it's like he was not one of those people saying, yeah, let them die. You know?
Right. He said, let the churches take care of them, which the churches are incapable of doing. Just look around you.
Sure. And, you know, the Austrian, you know, economic theory is all theory. There's no empirical data.
Yep.
That's the biggest knock on it. And, you know, even Paul Krugman, which I don't agree with him on trade or anything, but he was saying how it doesn't make any sense if resources are allocated between consumption and investment, then you'd think that when federal rates went down, that consumption should go down and unemployment should go down. But that's not what happens.
No, it's not. The Austrian school, this is utopian idealism. This is the whole problem with libertarianism, the Libertarian Party objectivism, is the predicating words are, if only everybody. And you never get that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And so they're trying to create this incredible, perfect world that doesn't exist. And never has, never will.
Since I lost every dime, I laid on the line, bought the theater from Des Moines, could put a coin in the door of the John and get 20 ponies.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, I'd really rather you didn't know all about. Excuse me. Okay, I was talking with Congressman Steve King at the beginning of the hour, and I said, Steve, Congressman King, isn't it horrible that the banksters are fixing to give themselves $156 billion this year? And he said, $156 billion, could it really be that much money? That's more than we spent in Iraq. Well, yeah. And I said, you know, now that you say that, he says, you sure that's not millions? And so, yeah, we've checked the numbers. You can find it over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, and all the links and everything. It is $156 billion. As we speak, Paul is calling Congressman King's office to say, have their people tell Congressman King that, yep, thanks for being on the show. And it is $165 billion that the banksters are taking. Meanwhile, 1 in 45 children in America is homeless. Half of the population of the United States lives in poverty or near poverty conditions and is within months if they lost their job. And most of those jobs are not particularly good jobs. If they lost their jobs, is within months of destitution. We are in a Great Depression. I find it fascinating. Steve Keen, the economist from Australia, pointed out on this program a couple of weeks ago that it wasn't until the 1940s, I think he said 42, it might have been 45, that they started using the phrase Great Depression to describe what had happened in the 1930s. At the time, they didn't know what it was. Franklin Roosevelt referred to it as the Troubles. We will not let these economic troubles, things like that. Or the rise of the economic royalists. So, anyhow, it is raining cash on Wall Street, just so you know. Ted in Kapatchet, Rhode Island. How do you say that, Ted?
It's Kapatchet.
Kapatchet. Great. Hey, yeah. What's up?
What's up? Well, I just got Dish TV, and I just discovered Free Speech TV, and I just discovered you.
Well, thank you. Glad to hear about that.
Thank you for doing your job, Tom.
I'm doing my best. So you registered a new PAC? Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell me about it.
It's the 99 Percenters PAC, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Now, most PACs either endorse or oppose a candidate. This is a ballot advocacy PAC.
Uh-huh.
We have two goals here. One is to get the money out of politics, which means public funding of the campaigns here in Rhode Island. And the second is a constitutional convention so we can come together with a people's platform. We have not had a constitutional convention in Rhode Island since 1986.
So you're talking about a state constitutional convention?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm very wary of federal constitutional conventions, and the reason why is I've seen, ballot initiatives, for example, in California and Oregon. When I lived in Oregon, there were, perfectly insane things. Like, for example, whenever the state has a surplus, you would think that if the state shows a surplus that year because it was a particularly good year economically, like we were in a little bubble like happened, during Clinton and during Bush and during, in any case, that they would set that money aside in a rainy day fund. Most states do that. They show a surplus. They just hang on to it. These right-wing wackadoodles put this thing on the ballot that if the state shows a surplus, they have to write refund checks to all the taxpayers. In other words, the state has to be broke at the end of every other year, which is the budget cycle. And if the state needs to raise taxes, in other words, if the economy collapses but they still want to keep their schools open, it requires a two-thirds majority of the House and Senate to pass the law, which is, it ain't going to happen or ain't going to happen in anything short of just a screaming, flaming emergency, and even then probably it wouldn't happen. And you would think that the good citizens of Oregon would look at this and go, this is insane. But a whole bunch of outside money came in. This was a test case that was being run by ALEC, the American Legislative Council, and the Koch brothers and other right-wing, funders. I'm not sure the details of this specific one, but typically Oregon is one of those states where they do these test things because it's big enough to test them, but it's small enough that they can do it relatively inexpensively. And they actually got people to vote for it. And that's my fear of constitutional conventions, is that right now with our politics and our political messaging and our media being controlled by a very small handful of very wealthy and powerful individuals and corporations, that they will promote agendas that are not good for democracy. And if you open up a constitution to be tinkered with, then heaven only knows what's going to come out of that.
Well, Rhode Island is small enough, obviously, that I believe that we could be the petri dish for the nation.
Yeah, it may well be. You may well be right. I don't know the state that well. On the other hand, my advice always would be pick a constitutional amendment instead that solves the specific problem you're concerned about or solves multiple problems and push for that constitutional amendment rather than opening the entire constitution up so that it can be, you know, every item can be debated, picked apart, taken apart, and possibly discarded. But in either case, I applaud your efforts to say, you know, we're here for the 99% and we want to change the Constitution because clearly the Constitution of the state of Rhode Island isn't working for the 99%. And you know, good on you. Good luck for it. Is there a website for it?
Not yet. As a matter of fact, that should be happening next week. You know, I'm 64 years old and retired, and I've been an activist since 1976.
Good on you.
So I'm kind of old school here, but really behind the times, you know, on the technology, although... Yeah. There are people, friends of mine, that are quite adept at it. Yeah. So that's the next step.
Yeah, get your kids and grandkids involved. Ted, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. Good on you. And when you have a URL, when you have a website, you know, let us know. We'll you can come on and give it a plug. David in Manhattan, New York. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, I got the best case scenario here.
Okay.
Tell me what you think about this.
Yeah.
Ron Paul, President of the United States.
All right.
Senate loaded up with Dems.
Right.
Congress loaded up with Dems.
Right.
Now we're in a situation where Ron Paul starts giving back our liberties and everything, and all of his crazy stuff never passes the Senate or House.
You know, I have, in moments, in non-public moments, I have contemplated that very thing. And this, of course, is a very public moment. And I'll tell you, you know, my biggest concern with Ron Paul being president, my two biggest concerns are, number one, that the president does have considerable veto power and considerable power to he can't dial forward, but he can dial back on things.
Right.
And so Ron Paul would have the ability, arguably, to do serious damage to things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, the low-income heating program, heating assistance program, and other just core social safety net stuff that he doesn't think should exist. And I'm concerned about that.
Really, he could just eliminate them?
He can't eliminate them entirely, but he might be able to veto bills that fund them, for example, from year to year, which would functionally do the same thing. The other concern that I have is that there are, over the next 4 years, over the next 5 years, you've got at least two and probably three, maybe four members of the Supreme Court who are going to retire or who are so old and so unwell that they may kick the bucket. I mean, I'm not wishing them that or anything like that. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is a champion of the rights of the people, is very elderly and has had cancer several times. Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote, will be in his late 70s, moving into his 80s in the next presidential term, if my recollection is correct, certainly his late 70s, and is rather frail. Scalia's in his 70s, but he's a robust 70s. So anyhow, there's a couple of these people who may be leaving the court, and the next president is going to pick their replacements. And Ron Paul's political philosophy would take the court back to the Lochner court. I mean, he would take it back to the court of 1917, the court that said that, because Ron Paul believes these things, the court that said that unemployment insurance is unconstitutional, that minimum wage laws are unconstitutional, that child labor laws are unconstitutional, that Social Security is unconstitutional. I mean, he believes those things, so he would appoint that kind of person to the Supreme Court. So it would be worse than Judge Bork. And because the Supreme Court...
I know it's tricky, though, but Obama is, he's, to me, he seems like a puppet. for the powers that be. He really doesn't.
Obama, I mean, in some ways, has absolutely caved and capitulated, particularly in the financial arena. On the other hand, Obama has done some really remarkable things that he doesn't get credit for, doesn't take credit for, because for whatever reason, he doesn't pat himself on the back enough and the Democrats aren't organized enough to get their message out.
We'll compromise. How about Ron Paul gets a GOP nomination, debates the hell out of Obama, smacks him around a little bit, and then we move forward with that while the Occupy Wall Street people are demanding get money out of politics.
I would love to see Ron Paul debating, as the Republican nominee, debating and ultimately losing to Barack Obama and causing him to seriously have to take seriously, because Ron Paul might be changing the tenor of things in the nation. Things like America as empire with 800 or 900 military bases around the world and the general insanity of that. America protecting our, you know, basically to protect our oil routes. And the only people that profit on this are transnational oil corporations that don't pay a penny. In fact, they pay no taxes. ExxonMobil
right,
not only paid no
tax,
they got
with that one.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, that's a reasonable compromise. And I think that, you know, once Ron Paul's positions on domestic issues are well known by the American people, there's no way that he would have a chance of getting elected, which is why the Republicans are running scared and why they're even talking about tinkering with their own voting mechanism in Iowa, which is a very interesting thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in D.C. But I got to tell you, in Iowa, the Republicans are actually talking about locking down their own voting systems.
So what are we going to do?
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Talk Radio News segment brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st Century, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And by no small coincidence, Ellen Ratner is on the line with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Okay, well, wow. What can I say? There was quite a vote today, 229 to 193, basically disapproving of the Senate's bill that was passed going to conference. Steny Hoyer got up afterwards and said this creates uncertainty and anxiety. If there's no agreement, this is going to hurt 160 million Americans, going to see their taxes increase. 48 million are going to see increased difficulty finding physicians because of the Medicare fix. Unemployment will go up, etc. He then said that the Americans and Speaker Boehner thought we had an agreement. Of course, Boehner's disagreeing with this. And he said, if this was about tax for the upper class, a tax cut for the upper class, it would pass like lightning. He said,
this was a tax cut for people making under $106,000 a year. This was a tax cut for people making $22,000 a year and $18,000 a year and, you know, $36,000 a year. That's what this tax cut was for, that the Republicans just voted down in the House of Representatives.
That's right. And Tom Price from the House Republican Policy Committee said the Senate proposals are unworkable. And then it's interesting because Jay Carney just did his briefing, and he was actually kind of funny today. He said the president should not be a marriage counselor between the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans. He said
really?
The right course of action is to get this House bill, but he said this is done as a result of avoidance. It got a sweeping vote in the Senate. He said this is not a game, as you were saying, John, for $1,000 for people struggling, this is a big deal.
Yeah, and if the House Republicans get their way, and basically, let's call it what it is, the Tea Party faction in the House, if the Eric Cantor and his right-wing crazies, the libertarian faction, as it were, if they get their way, then it is going to lead to somewhere between 40 and 150 or maybe 200,000 people losing their jobs over the next few months. It's going to lead to a drop in the economy in general. It's going to lead to an increase in unemployment. And there are some people who think that that's exactly what they want going into a presidential election, where the president's biggest liability is the economy.
For sure. Absolutely. Now, interesting, Mr. Boehner got up, Speaker of the House. He said, well, it's only a $166 tax cut because it's only for 2 months. He said, we want to do this for 12 months, just as the president requested. Now, this is Boehner speaking.
Right.
He said, the American people expect us to do his work, and it's inconvenient to try and resolve. We made a motion to go to conference. We want the Senate to come back and resolve our differences, and that's what the people want us to do. We're here now, and this would give the people a real Christmas bill. And so what's interesting is, of course, they're trying to say, well, we're going to stay in session.
Right.
No, they're not. They're all taken off this afternoon. There's one vote at 3:30 today, and then they're bye-bye.
Right. And they're bye-bye until when?
Until they're, whenever they get called back. I mean, I just don't know. The president
right.
says he's going to bring people in. The White House is not committing one way or the other on any of this.
Yeah.
Now, what's really interesting is, of course, the Senate is out, but sort of not out because they have a pro forma thing, or actually this is the House, sorry. The House will be out, but not out. The Senate is actually in recess. But the issue is, does the president have the power to make an appointment when there's sort of what we call a pro forma session, one or two people are there to call the Senate in session for an hour a day.
Right.
It turns out that there were 100 recess appointments made by Teddy Roosevelt, and he made them often when the Senate, when there was, just out for even an hour.
Right.
And so now the question is, the deal has been if the Senate doesn't meet for 3 days, then the president can do a recess appointment. This has been going on since like 1933.
Sure.
But now the question is, Teddy Roosevelt did it. The White House believes that they have the power to do this.
Yes.
Richard Cordray from the Consumer Protection Bureau, two nominees to the National Labor Relations Board, FDIC, all of those have not and will not go through. And basically, the White House is probably going to make those appointments because they believe legally they can.
Well, and the other option is if they don't do it during this holiday period when Congress is gone for 3 days, or if, Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell try to stick around or have, the Virginia or Maryland representatives show up every day to do pro forma sessions, still at the end of the year, there is an actual end of session and beginning of new session that may last only 1 second, but in the interval of that 1 second, the president could insert all of those.
He'll find a way to do it. There is no question.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
There's this business of what's going on in Iraq, and the president is out at Andrews Air Force Base as we speak, receiving the flag that was flown over our forces in Iraq. And this, of course, is the same time that this Iraqi VP thing is going on, who's a Sunni, although it's mainly a Shiite government. And he said today the charges were fabricated to make President al-Maliki want to embarrass him. And so he said that these are just totally not true. So it looks like we have a Sunni-Shiite, I won't say war yet, but it's not going to be pretty.
In Iraq?
In Iraq.
Do you think that the original Biden suggestion might end up being what, where the country is broken into three parts plus Kurdistan?
Well, yes, I think it makes sense. It was very interesting, my right-wing friend who isn't always right-wing, Jim Pinkerton, and I and Shalene Espinoza were in Iraq in June 2003.
Right.
And we looked around and said, you're putting three of the most disparate groups of people together.
Right.
Well,
they were put together by the British Empire after World War
I. The Brits made the world. We know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is certainly a huge issue that's going on right now.
Yeah.
And there goes the music.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have to end it there. But thank you, Ellen Ratner, for that, for the update, and for the good news on the recess appointments. Great to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. We'll be back 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, in our 9th year now. Oh, we've been doing this a long time. And having a fine time doing it. WCPT in Chicago is our Chicago affiliate, and not only is just, you know, a great progressive station, it's one of the few in the country that's locally owned, independently operated, doing some just marvelous work. And they are on Christmas Eve going to be running a play on AM820 WCPT from 10 a.m. Central Time. And this play is going to be called Occupy My Heart, a Revolutionary Christmas Carol. It's based on Dickens' classic, and I'm assuming that that classic is a Christmas carol. And it's being put together by W.C. Bill Turk, the writer-producer of Occupy My Heart, a Revolutionary Christmas Carol. And this is for the benefit of Occupy Chicago. OccupyShy.org is that website. Bill, is that you with us?
That is me. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. Really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for joining us. And should I call you WC or Bill or both or what?
Bill works just fine. Thank
okay.
you. I publish under WC, but Bill works wonderfully.
Okay, great. It's T-U-R-C-K, by the way, for people who might be trying to track you down and say hi or find out what you're up to. So tell me, the information I have says that you went out and recruited actors, basically, among the Occupy Chicago movement for this play that you're going to be performing both on the radio station and in other venues. Tell us about it. First of all, is that accurate? And then secondly, you know, how did this come about?
Well, you know, I have been active with the group and a supporter of the group, and visiting the site daily. I work very, very close to where the protest happens, out in front of the Bank of America daily. I have an arts background. I'm a painter and author. I was also in Sarajevo on the heels of Susan Sontag's Waiting for Godot during the siege in the 90s. So that sort of passionate activism, arts activism, has always resonated very strongly with me. And I was running into so many people with creative backgrounds, painters and illustrators and singers and actors and theater people, that I thought there needs to be a way to channel some of that creative force into something that really propels the organization forward, the movement forward, and broadens its scope and broadens its appeal and offers its message to people who might not be as available to the message otherwise.
So you rewrote A Christmas Carol, sort of, or wrote something inspired by A Christmas Carol. And you want to give us a real quick synopsis, like just a minute or so, synopsis of what this is?
Yeah, I think it's a far less cynical take on A Christmas Carol than
A Christmas Carol at its time was considered a far left. You know, it
really was.
Yeah.
The story itself is very natural to the movement. Scrooge being personifying the 1%, and he has a change of heart on a Christmas Eve. And so our story follows that template. But it tells the story of a Chicago banker who has a crisis of faith one Christmas Eve near the site of the protest, and reunites with a long-lost love with the help of three very urban and very odd spirits. It's definitely not not as scary as the original. And Josh really is not a bad guy. He's actually a very likable guy. And his arguments, even for his point of view as the 1%, are pretty compelling, but the spirits and his own conscience and his past sort of bring him around to a new way of seeing the world and seeing the protest, and it's a nice family friendly play. It's written
great.
An hour long. The initial inspiration was to do this on the street corner. Within the protest, we've actually evolved a little bit beyond that. So now we're doing we're performing the play this Friday at 3 p.m. in Grant Park for the protest.
That's great.
But then we have some theater dates, and then we have the
we have the radio play on Saturday.
The gig on Saturday, 10 a.m. Central Time on WCPT AM 820 in Chicago, and directed by Kay Hannah Friedman, and the writer-producer Bill Turk, WC Bill Turk, and Occupy My Heart, A Revolutionary Christmas Carol. I find it just extraordinary, all the cool stuff that has come out of the Occupy movement, that we're no longer sitting around talking about Republican talking points. That
there's an amazing creative energy out there, and this play is really about that. And if I could say one more quick thing about the heart and soul of this play, the play itself is and the movement to bring the play to fruition is really illustrative of the whole movement. You know, as a writer, I sat down to write two-dimensional words on a page. But it was really the community coming together. It was folks like Marshall Stearns, producer Greg Alexander at WCPT. It was, Father Ted Curtis who's provided the rehearsal space for us. It was all of the folks, in Occupy Chicago. It was all of the actors that we drew directly from the protest. It's been theater owners. It's been folks coming forward with some of the odd props that we'll use. It really has been a communal effort to realize the potential for this play.
That is absolutely marvelous. So, and Bill Turk, the OccupyShy.org, do they have information about the play, or are you just, you know, doing it to help promote them? And
we are on the front page at this moment.
Okay, you can check it out at OccupyShy.org and check that out. And it's this is the play Occupy My Heart, A Revolutionary Christmas Carol. Bill, thanks so much for what you're doing and for coming on the show and sharing it with us.
Sam, a pleasure. Thanks for being a good voice out there.
I do. Oh, it's an honor, and an honor having you on the program. Thank you so much. Let's see here. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom Hartman.
Well, hello, Gary. I haven't heard from you in a while. How you doing?
Miss you, Tom.
So what's up?
Always miss you. Always miss a great, you know, I put this up there.
I'm still here.
Well, I know.
So, but what's the point? What's the point that you call to make?
All right. Greed has no heart. I hope sincerely I've been making a contribution on that.
Yeah, you have been pushing that mantra for a long, long time, and greed has no heart, and I think it is it's a perfect bumper sticker.
Well, Merry Christmas to you and to everybody in the chat room. I sincerely mean that. You know, I mean that says Merry Christmas to all of you.
Merry Christmas to you too, Gary.
Thank you. If you will, I have some unsolicited advice for President Obama, who really I admire as a person.
You have about a half a minute here. Go for it.
Okay, that's all right. I can get it in a half a minute.
I figured you could.
I know. But I'm
if you got it,
line,
but you got to get to it.
I can. Now I'm a DD Democrat. What's that mean? I'm a disgruntled, disgusted Democrat right now. I'll tell you why. President Obama, don't fear your own tongue going forward.
Yeah.
Don't fear your own tongue.
Yep.
You caved in again about taxes, and this is not acceptable to me. Frankly,
yeah.
And where is the trade issue? Nobody's talking about the trade issue.
Trade problem is one that both parties have, Gary, as you well know. And actually, right now, the Republicans are kind of going down in flames in the House of Representatives, and Obama is not stepping in to prevent that, which I think is kind of cool. But Gary, I get your point, and thank you very much for saying it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Particularly for your kind words to us, I can't speak on behalf of the president. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. It is the holiday season, and every year at this time, we just take one short little segment of a couple of minutes to raise consciousness about two programs that kind of run as one, the Salem Children's Village and the Hunter School up in New Hampshire, that Louise and I started back in 1978, and that survive in part because of your donations. And the Hunter School in particular, right now, we're trying to grow that program a little bit, and also offer scholarships to people whose school districts are fighting them, who may not have the resources, we have a summer program actually also for kids, and that you know, school districts won't have anything to do with. And many parents have these, we refer to them as energetically sensitive children. They're very reactive to their environment. Sometimes the diagnosis is Asperger's syndrome or severe ADHD or things like that. But we've all in our lives, you and I, have had times when we needed a little help. And I can tell you educationally, you know, as somebody who I certainly would have qualified as ADHD when I was a kid, I was saved by Sputnik going up in 1957, 56, 57, whatever the year was. I was in the second grade, and as I recall. And Dwight Eisenhower put into place this program where he said, okay, we're going to flood our schools with cash and resources, and we're going to create a generation of engineers and scientists. And I was one of a couple of kids that was pulled out of my public school and put into a special program where we could just learn as fast as we could, which is, you know, sort of what happens at Hunter's. I mean, it's a 4-to-1, 4 students to 1 teacher ratio, and in some cases it's 1-to-1, depending on the child. It's really an extraordinary program. And that saved my life. I really think that had I not had a unique educational opportunity, now it wasn't one like Hunter Schools, but had I not had that, had that not been available to me, I probably just would have been another one of those kids that was given Ritalin and stuck in the corner. And this is a moment that you can help these kids. And so what we're asking you to do is go to hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org. You can see both programs. And they're in the same physical place. But the Hunter School is the one that has grown the most and for which we're having the most demand, frankly. And the donations that we're getting, some of them are going to be used to maintain the program, to cover, you know, some of the expenses that we've had in the past and that we're having in the future moving forward and things. The program is in the red right now. We're trying to bring it into the black for the end of the year. Our goal last year was to raise $20,000, which wrapped up the year for us, and we did that. We accomplished that last year. We're trying to raise $20,000 again this year with this fundraiser. And to that end, we're sending out a copy. These are being donated by the publisher, Barrett Kohler Publishers, BK Publishers, of my new book, The Tom Hartman Reader, with any donation of over $250 or more. And if you give by PayPal, they deduct like $3, so your donation becomes $247 or something like that. But that's fine. That gets you a book. And I just want to share a letter. This is from a parent of one of the kids. I was so excited, sad, and hopeful back in February 2011 when I saw Lori from the Hunter School on Oprah. Hearing you and your son's story was like watching the video of my son and I. It had been a very difficult 10 years, but now I finally feel like there's hope. We aren't the only ones. I'm very excited at the possibility that, and she names her son, I don't want to use names on the air, we'll be able to attend the Hunter School in January and we'll be able to receive the amazing care and support the school has to offer, especially being able to work with Michael. He's one of the people who works with these he says actually him helping these wonderfully sensitive children find a way to a peaceful, giving, whole humans will be a gift to our whole society, the whole planet. They have amazing gifts, and if they can just find their way through all the negative energy of this world, they'll be able to rise above it and shine their glorious gifts. Thank you for all the work that you and your staff and board are doing at the Hunter School to help these lost children blossom into the beautiful beings that they are. And she signs it, Namaste, Danielle. And it's just, you know, the parent of one of the kids. And here's a clip. This is 10-year-old Zach, this is clip number 13, Jacob. He was the son, he is the son of Lori Ferris, who's the associate who helps run the program, and she helps run our program because she put her son in our program way back years ago when he was just totally out of control. And in fact, Lisa I'm forgetting, I think Lisa Gardner, the famous novelist, wrote a novel, which is what led her to end up on Oprah, about a kid who tried to kill his mother, and that was this child, and how out of control he was. Here he is, here's Zach on Oprah, this last, just a few months ago.
When I'm doing an interview with somebody who's full of negativity, I surround myself with that light to try to keep myself from having that energy enter my space. So
don't try. Do.
Don't try.
Do.
Do.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you worry about what you might do in the future?
No.
You're not worried about that?
No.
Because you think you can control it?
I am controlling it.
Okay. Don't think. Do.
Do. Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. The 10-year-old Zach teaching Oprah. That you can't see. Yeah, Jacob says he's a little Zen master, and that's the stuff that, you know, that's how we're helping kids at the Hunter School. And you can check this out at hunterschool.org. Any donation over $250, any amount is needed, but we're trying to raise $20,000, and in a relatively short period of time here, and any donation over $250, and we'll send a copy of this book, which actually has a chapter or two in it about how we started the program, the Tom Hartman Reader. Signed by me and donated by the publisher. So just let you know, and then we'll get back to all the politics and all the general craziness of the day right after this break. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure, please, check out hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org. Be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly. Stick around. Yeah, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly-somely ugly. To you by EdisonFactor.com, food for the brain. The good, Democratic Congressman John Yarmuth and Walter Jones. They are the latest members of Congress to hear the message of the Occupy Wall Street movement and introduce legislation to overturn the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision and kick corporate money out of our politics. The legislation amends the Constitution to say that money is not speech, and it also sets up a publicly financed election system. As Congressman Yarmuth said about his bill, until we get big money out of politics, we will never be able to responsibly address the major issues facing American families. And that starts by ensuring our elections and elected officials cannot be bought by the well-off and well-connected. Well said. Go to movetoamend.org to find out what else you can do to take back our democracy. The bad. New Hampshire Republicans, six right-wing lawmakers in the Republican-controlled state legislature are pushing legislation to display warning signs on the road for drivers about to enter nearby Massachusetts. The signs would read, "Warning, Massachusetts border 500 feet." One Republican co-sponsor of the bill said that it was intended to warn people that they were no longer in the live free or die state. New Hampshire prides itself on not having laws regarding seatbelts, guns, cell phones while driving, and motorcycle helmets. But Massachusetts prides itself on having the best health care in the country, which makes you wonder which state actually needs a warning sign. Either way, it's another bad idea by Republicans who don't seem too bothered wasting state money erecting street signs to bash their neighbor. As one Democratic Party spokesman said, no wonder voters have self-identified the Republican legislature as one of the three most serious problems facing New Hampshire. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. Making this list for the second day in a row, Limbaugh's declared that last year's BP oil spill was a non-story. That's right, Limbaugh said, nobody really remembers what the AP top story of 2010 was. It was the BP oil spill, which of course ended up being a non-story. It was a non-starter, it was a non-story. Really? The BP oil spill was a non-story? Let's see. It killed 11 people immediately and was the worst environmental disaster the United States has ever faced in its history. Gulf Coast communities are still feeling the effects of it and likely will indefinitely. But I guess if your one job is to be a shell on the radio for transnational corporations like BP, like Limbaugh's is, then you see things a little differently. And that's very, very ugly. By the way, speaking of Occupy, one of the folks in the chat room said, check out Occupy our home. Actually, it would be occupyyourhome.com, except that it's OccupyOur Home. So it's Occupy Our Home. I wonder what happens if I put a second Y in there. Do they have both URLs or not? Well, let me just find out here. No, that does not work. So it's occupyourhome.org, and it's what it is, people putting up tents in their yards. So that's kind of cool. Occupyourhome.org. Pitch a tent in your front yard in support of the Occupy movement. We've been talking today about, you know, what can you do, to basically help the Occupy movement. And there's a lot of great things that you can do. So all of that said, Jeremy in Chicago. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, thanks for the opportunity. Off the heels of the news of the AT&T merger that recently folded, let's not be quick to forget that earlier this year, the lobbying efforts of and by one former FCC commissioner, Ms. Meredith Baker, in favor of the recently sealed Comcast GE NBC Universal deal.
Yep.
Now, Comcast, not all that shiny themselves as an entity, but recently agreed to pay some $6 million to settle some discrepancies with overtime and wages that they failed to pay some Northern Illinois call center representatives. So now Ms. Baker herself is the senior vice president of governmental affairs for the same corporation.
Yeah, so in other words, it's the revolving door all over again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, the money in the politics is, you know, high-paying positions are just as good as cash in this economic environment. And I wanted to bring that up.
And they always have been. And, you know, highly placed politicians or bureaucrats, for that matter, particularly in things like military, and thanks for the call, Jeremy, particularly in things like military procurement. I mean, you get to be a general with a couple of stars, and you have something to do with procuring things. You got a pretty good job waiting for you in the private sector when you leave in the military-industrial complex. It's really a disaster. Michael in Milton, Florida. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing fine. It's raining where I'm at. But anyways, if not Ron Paul, then who? Like, new to Romney, they're both corrupted. I mean, there's corruption.
Yeah.
All over the political parties, you know. You can't help that because where there's money, there's corruption. But what's your outlook on it?
I think that Ron Paul is probably one of the least corrupt members of Congress, to the extent that he hasn't been corrupted by specific, hey, you do this, I'll do that kinds of money. On the other hand, he believes in an ideology that would turn our nation over to a cabal of very wealthy individuals and large corporations. And he believes in doing away with the inheritance tax altogether so that multi-generational wealth would become dynastic wealth, and we would end up basically a few generations down the road as a kingdom. And so to that extent, I think Ron Paul is arguably the most corrupt of the presidential candidates, because he believes in an ideology that is the most antithetical to that on which this country was founded. Thomas Paine, I encourage you to read, at the very least, Agrarian Justice. Thomas Paine would have been horrified by libertarianism. Thomas Jefferson would have been horrified by these ideas. These guys believed that they were creating a society where people looked out for each other and we were all in this together. Thomas Jefferson created the first free college in the United States, the University of Virginia, where he said, a man's station at birth should not be the thing that determines his ability to get an education. That's not a verbatim quote, but very close to it. And you know, in fact, he positioned his house so he could see the University of Virginia down the hill. He was so proud of it, he put it on his tombstone rather than the fact that he was president of the United States. So in that regard, you know, everybody thinks Ron Paul is this squeaky clean guy. I think he is.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah, well, I think his philosophy is destructive and antithetical to American values. I agree with him that we should end the drug war. I agree with him that we should stop trying to play empire around the world. I agree with much of his foreign policy, not all of it, but much of it. And I agree with him that victimless crimes, at the very least, should be regulated or perhaps just, you know, open the marketplace, although I'm concerned that if you just completely open the marketplace, then you're just going to end up with, you know, prostitution cartels and heroin cartels. You know, I think that there is a place for some regulation in all of those marketplaces, as other countries do it.
And it'd be like a repeat of the Craigslist, the whole Craigslist thing.
All hell breaks loose. Well, that in part actually is created by the fact that it's illegal, you know, and so you're creating a black market that is a total black hole black market. But, you know, gray markets aren't good either, and you're seeing those in some of, for example, some of the states, the former Soviet states or nations that are just flipping forms of government where they haven't yet gotten to the point where they're regulating things, and you're seeing human trafficking going on. And, you know, not a good thing. And so I these are the kind of things that would come about, in my opinion, as a result of Ron Paul's policies, that young people who think that it's so cool to be a libertarian are not thinking through, don't have any understanding of, don't have any experience with, haven't been out in the world, have never been in those nations that are close to being libertarian, where there's very little government and basically all the government does is run the police and the military. And that's the world that Ron Paul would have us have. And I'd rather not live in the libertarian paradise of Somalia. Thank you very much. You know, I kind of like the United States. So that's my take on it, Michael. Thanks for the call. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up with you?
Tom, hi. It's beautiful out here, you know, but I'm going to tell you this. I was listening to you talk about the Wall Street solidarity earlier. And I think that what we've got to get back to, let's not let this occupation movement fade as a movement.
Yep.
Let us take the 1%, let us take the 99%, and let's join the 1% with the 99%, and we will have a whole nation if we have that one purpose. Then 1% to 99%. The one purpose, to respect human dignity, to respect human dignity.
But how do you do that when you have a portion of the 1%? There's a large chunk of the 1% that are really good, decent people. In fact, the majority of them are saying, please raise my taxes. But what do you do when you have a small portion of them who have an outsized influence in the world because, like the Koch brothers, they're willing to use their wealth to manipulate the political process and public opinion in ways that benefit them and other large, you know, polluting industries and other wealthy individuals, and basically harm everybody else. What do you do?
Exactly. And the music is on, and I'm going to have to get to you about that another time. Love
okay.
you, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour. Check out our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Oh, you tell them, Leonard. And don't forget, by the way, hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org. Salemchildrensvillage.org. 866-97-THOM. And it's amazing. Don in Mansfield, Ohio. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. These credit reporting agencies, I've had...
Yeah, we had a caller earlier who said that because he hadn't borrowed any money in a couple of years, his credit score was zero. It's like they only reward you if you borrow, if you pay them interest, if you're a good interest slave, I guess. It's too strong a word, but you get the point.
Yes. They don't take into account if you have a home that's totally paid off.
Yep.
They don't have any idea what kind of paid-off cars you have or any other assets. And they really don't care. It's just what amount of credit are you using? When I used to be in the gasoline business, people would want to open an account with us, and we would do a D&B, Dun and Bradstreet.
I remember those. I had a business where we used D&B years ago.
How did we evolve from a D&B, which gives the total picture of somebody's financial health,
right,
to just this credit-based system?
You know, I don't know. My recollection of the D&B system, and I'll say right up front, it's been at least 20 years since I used it. It was a business that we had in the 80s, as I recall.
Yes.
They used Dun & Bradstreet. And when we ran a credit profile on a company, first of all, they would have to voluntarily submit, and as we did. I remember when D&B came in and audited my company so that I could be in their database and they could say that the information that we provided was accurate. And I had to give them my bank statements. I had to give them my list of aged payables, aged receivables, you know, everything, the whole thing. Right. They basically came in and did a one-day audit as if they were the IRS. And they gave us a number, a D&B number, that was not our EIN number. And you know, people would publish their D&B numbers. And so when you would, you know, talk about doing business, and what you'd get from somebody wasn't a rating. D&B didn't say, oh, this is a A or a C or a 512, my recollection. They actually gave you a list of, you know, what this company had done or some of it. They protected a lot of the information because of confidentiality, but
sure.
I don't know how we got here. You know, I think that the whole credit rating system is rigged to reward borrowing, responsible borrowing, that is profitable for the banksters borrowing, and to punish people who either don't borrow or people who can't borrow or who borrow, quote, irresponsibly, who borrow and don't pay back.
Right, and for your credit rating that they use these days, I checked a few years ago, and having a telephone landline rather than a cell phone, as long as you maintained a landline, that was worth 75 points on your credit score.
Seriously?
Yes.
Wow, I'm in trouble. Amazing. Amazing. Don, thanks a lot for the information. Great to hear from you. Janie in Round Rock, Texas. Hey, Janie, what's up?
Hello, and
hi.
Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Thank you. I was calling today about my thoughts on greed.
Okay.
I believe that greed is fear. And fear, of course, is a perceived vulnerability, a weakness, which is why I think people react to it with anger and defensiveness, even viciousness. So I think that this is a perspective that we can develop much further, and we can use it to completely change the direction or to add to our direction and our strategy kind of bring balance back, elevate ourselves and bring the greed down.
I think you're right. You know, many years ago, my old friend Marianne Williamson turned me on to the Course in Miracles, which she's very into. It's not my Bible, but she's a scholar of it. And one of the basic premises is that there's only two things in the world, you know, love and fear. And that all these things, like you said, greed, these are dimensions of fear. And, you know, so if you want to dig more into that, I would suggest checking that out. I think that somebody's done the research for you. But that's an interesting a very interesting suggestion, Janie. Thank you very much for that. Bo in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bo, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a quick comment. I think that folks in Congress should do away with the suits and wear Formula One race uniforms so we could see all their sponsor patches all over the
place.
That
is the title of one of the chapters in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's titled, Make Congress Wear NASCAR Patches. Is this Bo who owns the restaurant in Portland?
Oh, no, not
okay.
at all.
Different bow, okay.
Different bow.
All right, because I was going to give him an opportunity for a gratuitous plug, but anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Bo. I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you that, you know, we should say to our members of Congress, you know, if you're going to take money from these people, put the patch on. And by the way, let's extend that to the Supreme Court. I'd like to see Clarence Thomas wearing patches for all the money for the speeches that he's given, Scalia, the speeches that he's given, and for all the money that Ginny Thomas is making as well, because it's going into the Thomas family kitty there. And, you know, I've got a bit of a problem with that. So, anyhow, it is, I was going to pick up another call here, but Jacob says we are just flat out of time. Yep. Surprise, surprise. There comes the music. Thanks so much for being with us. Coming up on the Tom Hartman, on the next Tom Hartman program, over the holidays, many people will be heading to churches that our tax dollars pay for. Everything from their income to their mortgages is tax exempt. Is it time to change? Should we start taxing churches? Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, your media support group for We the People. Don't forget, it all begins when you get out there and show up. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.